So as Jim mentioned, I spent quite a long time at San Francisco Zen Center. Before that, I had a very checkered career. I waited on tables for many years and then went to drafting school and did drafting and then went to engineering school and was actually working in Silicon Valley at Advanced Micro Devices when I met Tenzin Anderson at the Yoga Room in Berkeley. And that kind of changed my life. And when I got to my sabbatical at AMD, I took it as a Tassajara practice period. And then when I was at Tassajara, I turned 50. And I thought, well, 50, that's old enough to decide what you want to do for yourself. And I don't really want to go back. And so I didn't. And that so my life unfolded at Zen Center. Roughly split half and half between Tassajara and Green Gulch. And then when my time to leave Zen Center was approaching, I felt I had always wanted to practice in Japan. And I thought, well, even though the thought terrified me, I thought, if I don't do it now, I won't have an opportunity because once you settle into something else, it's very hard to arrange your life in such a way that you can do something like that. Although it's not as hard as I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Because the temple that I went to in Japan, any one of you could go to as a layperson, you could go and practice there for a few days, or as a priest, you could go and practice there for a few days. So anyway, so I did that. I went to Toshoji for 3 months. During the time I was still at Green Gulch, I went to Toshoji and then I came back to Green Gulch and was Eno. And then I went back to Toshoji and then I asked Dzogchen Rogchi after 3 months or during the 3 months I was there if he would support me to be there for 1 year, if I could stay for a year. And he very graciously did that. And that's not such a small thing. You have to fill out a fair amount of paperwork. I mean, the Roshi has to fill out a fair amount of paperwork and also pay your healthcare fees in Japan. Everyone has to be on the national healthcare plan, so the temple must pay for the priests who come there. So that was a completely amazing experience in my life to practice at that temple, and I feel a great pull to go back there. I don't know if I ever will. But I feel a pull to go back there. Just to say a little bit about it, there's a book. I'm blocking on the name of it right now. Perhaps some of you have read it. It's written by I think it's called Eat, Sleep, Sit. Does anybody know this book? The person who oh, okay. Doralee knows it. This book was written by a person in Japan who, at a particular time in his life, decided to become a monk, and he went to Aihachi Monastery, and he was at Aihachi for a year, and then he went back to his life, and over time he wrote a book about it. It's an absolutely wonderful book and completely amazing. But if you're going to Japan for an ongo, don't. Even if you read it, don't pick it up and read it again right before you start because it will just terrify you. Because it starts with him approaching Aihachi and climbing the steps and being thrown down the steps, and the monks had to keep climbing up and getting literally tossed down the steps. That's how it was done at the time he was there, at least, which was 1985. So even though I was told I had nothing to worry about going to Toshoji, an international Zen training monastery. I did feel some trepidation. And not only did I feel some trepidation, I felt quite strange. And that strangeness was that the tradition is that you arrive in traditional monastic attire, which means a kromo like I'm wearing now, this garment, not my own kesef, but the kromo, but hiked up in a particular way, tied up, and then a rakasu on top of that, and ideally a particular kind of pack on your back, and a hat. So I didn't have the backpack and I didn't have the hat, but I did. Reverend Galen Godwin taught me how to arrange my robes properly. So I did that in my hotel room. And I knew I needed a little extra time, so I asked at the hotel if I could stay later. And they told me how much it would cost to stay later. And I said, okay, you know. And then when I came down and they saw how I was dressed, they said, you don't have to pay anything extra, which I thought was very sweet. So I went to the temple and I took a taxi there. And even though the more traditional way is that you walk to the temple, but I just couldn't manage it. So then I was standing outside and I knew I was to strike the horn 3 times, which I did. But as I was standing there, I just thought, what on earth are you doing? You're wearing these strange clothes in a culture that's unfamiliar to you. And this is just weird. I didn't quite articulate it that way, but that was the feeling. This is just weird. But I did what I was supposed to do. I struck the han vigorously 3 times, and then I waited outside. I tried to stand in shashu and just calm deportment and all of that. And after some time, but not all that long, you know, there's in the tradition, they can keep you outside the monastery for 24 hours or more, you know, or certainly several hours at least, and then come out and throw water on you or toss you down the stairs or something. But that didn't happen. It was maybe 20 minutes or something. And then a senior nun came out, Esho-san came out, and I had never met her before. But as soon as I saw her face, I felt, oh, I came to the right place. It was that simple. There was a radiance to her face and a gentleness and a welcomingness that I had not at all anticipated. And that, in some sense, expressed something of the mind of Toshoji, the mind set there. It wasn't that it was without its strict side, because it was actually quite strict. There were several days of Tongaryo, the time when you show your intention by diligently sitting and being completely jet lagged. That's very difficult to do, and we were told we were allowed to nap, but it didn't really do any good, because you're just in this kind of strange space. So I did my best to sit zazen in my room, and after 2.5 days, I think it was, I got to the point where I thought, I'm going to have to go to Esho-san and just tell her I have to leave. I can't make it. This is impossible. I can't do it. And just as I was about to do that, she came to my room and said, Dojo Roshi wants you to end your tongue tonight, enter tomorrow morning. And it was very interesting to see how the mind changes. My mind completely switched in that moment, which shows the power of how we think about things. All of my feeling of I can't make it was just replaced by this feeling of course, this is wonderful. I had some sense of well-being. It was kind of strange. So later that same day, the person who was the head student came, the Shuso, came to show me how to do the entering ceremony, which is quite elaborate. And part of that ceremony, you do a jundo in the soto. It's what they call their zendo, the soto. And Toshoji, the soto, is very small. It's 17 seats, I think. No, 13 seats. Just 12 seats plus Dojo Roshi seat inside, and then there are external tons outside the gaitons, where there are another similar number of seats, and then there's a further ton outside. In that inner ton, only the monks who have entered the Ango are allowed to be inside that ton. But we went in to practice the Ango, practice the circumambulation that I would do. So part of that, of course, is you bow to the abbot. But the abbot wasn't there right then, so I was actually bowing to his seat. And in Japan, the abbot sits in a chair. It's higher than the ton. It's a little bit, it's a very big chair. The height, the seat of the chair is roughly the size of half a tatami mat. So kind of a yard by a yard. So the seat of the chair is quite large. And the Taroshi is not a terribly tall man. So he is not huge in the chair. I don't think any human being would be huge in the chair, not even a very tall person. But in any case, there he, at that time, he was not there. And so I was bowing to his seat, and on his seat was his zafu. And when I saw his zafu, I had this experience of feeling that there was nowhere to hide. His zafu was composed of patches almost entirely. It was a cushion that had been patched and patched and patched and patched again and again and again and again. And it wasn't anything remarkable. It was just sitting there. But I felt some sense of reproach. Like, what did I think practice was beyond patching a cushion? What kind of idea did I have? What was my sincerity? Some feeling like that. So that was my entrance to Toshoji. And I don't think I'm going to go on longer about my experience there, although if there's time for questions later and you want to ask me some specific questions, I'd be glad to talk about it further, but maybe that will give you some idea of that experience. Then in the bio, that the little bio that Jim gave of my resume, my history, he didn't say what happened after Toshoji because I didn't put it in there. But I came back to the United States, and I came to visit my mother in Palo Alto. And she, at that time, was 94, and now she's 97, and I have not left. And I've remained here, caring for her, although I'm not her only caregiver. But it's a very different life that I've been living now. And what I want to say about that is that the most important practice is not some ideal experience that we might have. Although when we have those, you know, if you have the opportunity and the wish to go to Toshoji, I would be very happy to do whatever I could to facilitate that for you. And I recommend it. But the real question for me is, what is practice now? What is it now in this condition, in the midst of the pandemic, where we've been locked down for such a long time? People were talking about getting their COVID-19 vaccines, and I'm having my first shot tomorrow. I could have made an appointment for today, but I was afraid of having a reaction that would in some sense impinge upon my ability to be with you, and I didn't want to do that. So tomorrow morning I will have my first shot. Today, my mother, who has glaucoma and macular degeneration and is nearly blind, almost completely blind, went for her eye injections that preserve the little sight that she has. And this is a very distressing thing for her. She only has to go over a few months, but it's an ordeal. And this afternoon she did not feel well. And so I was trying to prepare for this, and she called for me, but I didn't hear her. I'm deaf. This is our life. This is the breakup of the sense faculties. My mother is blind. I'm somewhat deaf, and we muddle along together. This is our life. But when I did go in to check on her, she was kind of upset with me that I hadn't heard her. And the disorientation on top of the discomfort of having these injections in the eye, it wasn't so easy initially, because in me, there was some resistance to the situation, because I was going to be talking to you tonight. And so I wanted to plan for tonight, and I wanted to, if you could see my room, I'm not going to do it, but if you could see a 360, I have a little nightstand set up between my bed that I'm sitting on and the chest of drawers. There's no room to negotiate in between. And after I set this up, I realized my case is over there. So I had to kind of catapult myself across the bed to get over there to get it. So it's that kind of situation, but I was setting it up and trying to see if there would be light and all of that. And she needed me. And the difficulty was not that she needed me. The difficulty was that I resisted it. That was the difficulty. That's almost always the difficulty. I imagine some of you have read this book, Dogen, Three Commentaries on the Genjo Koan. And in this book, I'm particularly fond of the commentary by Nichiara Bokusan. And I just wanted to talk about one thing he says in there. He's discussing the part where the part of the Genjo Koan firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood. You know, the part, how does it begin? Do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. Firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood. And on like that. And the comment that he makes about it is, he said, a Zen master of old said, I have a great power. Because of that, when the wind blows, I fall down. I have a great power. When the wind blows, I fall down. Do not suppose that the firewood will turn into ash, that the ash will turn it back into firewood. Ash is ash. It has its own past and future. Firewood is firewood. It has its own past and future. I have a great power. When the wind blows, I fall down. What is my life right now? Can I fall down? Can I allow my life to be what it is right now? You may know this koan. The one I'm going to read it to you. This one is the translation of D.T. Suzuki. It's Pai Lei Tien was a great poet of Dong. When he was officiating as governor in a certain district, there was a Zen master within his jurisdiction, popularly known as Nyoke, the bird's nest, for he used to practice his meditation on a seat made of the thickly growing branches of a tree. The governor poet once visited him and said, "What a dangerous seat you have up there in the tree." "Yours is far worse than mine," retorted the master. "I'm the governor of this district, and I don't see what danger there is in it." "Then you don't know yourself. When your passions burn and your mind is unsteady, what is more dangerous than that?" The governor then asked, "What is the teaching of Buddhism?" The master recited this famous stanza: "Not to commit evils, but to practice all good, and to keep the heart pure. This is the teaching of the Buddhas." Pai, however, protested, "Any child 3 years old knows that." Any child 3 years old may know it, but even an old man of 80 finds it difficult to practice it. So concluded the Zen master up in the tree. You know, I think when I came to practice, Jun was very kind, saying I was a warm presence in his ongo. I remember it a little bit differently. I remember myself as having a lot of angst at that time. And it's kind of maybe trying to get something out of Zen, trying to get enlightened or get somewhere in practice. Not to commit evils, but to practice all good, and to keep the heart pure. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So it's so simple, so simple. I have a great power. When the wind blows, I fall down. I just wondered if you'd be patient with me to read you one more thing, and then maybe we can talk a little bit. You know, we have our three pure precepts. You know, I vow to do all good. I vow to do no evil. Vow to do all good. Vow to save all beings, or vow to live for the benefit of all beings. So vowing to live for the benefit of all beings is in some sense replacing that keeping the heart pure in the Mahayana. Live for the benefit of all beings. So one of the things I've been doing, practicing in this different way now, living here in Palo Alto at my mother's house, taking care of her, is every morning I find some time to read sutras. And I really recommend this practice. I really recommend it. And I've had the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament sutra. I've had the sutra for 15 years at least, but I finally determined I would read it from cover to cover. So I'm going through it, and I'm in book 39, which is when Sudana goes on his pilgrimage to 53 enlightening beings. But as he's setting out, he first asks Manjushri his question, why he's setting out on this quest. And perhaps in listening to this question, you might ask if you if this is your question, if your question is somewhere in Siddhanta's question. Siddhanta said, "Noble One, please give me a full explanation of how an enlightening being is to study the practice of enlightening beings. How an enlightening being is to accomplish it. How is an enlightening being to initiate the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to carry out the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to fulfill the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to purify the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to comprehend the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to effect the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to follow the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to keep the practice of enlightening beings? How is an enlightening being to expand the practice of enlightening beings? How can an enlightening being fulfill the scheme of the universally good practice?" This is Siddhanta's question. How to be truly good? What is the universally good practice? I wonder if that's a good time to pause for questions.
I will entertain at least myself in asking a question. Thank you for your share. I am interested to know if what you have just read to us about enlightening beings and how to know how to maintain a good practice, whether that has anything to do with maintaining good posture. And what I'm proposing is that we don't need to know. You know, if we hold a good posture, some things will be taken care of for us. You asked a lot of questions from that reading, and we may not know the answers to many of them. But if we maintain that one basic question of how to be good, maybe that will help a lot. And I'm curious to know if you agree or could comment on that.
Well, it's a beautiful question. I really thank you for the question. It's a beautiful question. And I'll share that I come from a family where posture has not been so well developed necessarily. And many years ago, I made it my life ambition. I kind of felt I would be satisfied if on my tombstone, someone wrote good posture. I thought that would be great to have on the tombstone. My answer is kind of yes and no. Yes. To maintain our posture, it depends what you mean by maintain. Posture is not something fixed, to be immovable in some sense. Yes. But my own experience is, I can't say I have a great power, but I can say I think when the wind blows, I fall down. Maybe I don't fall all the way down, though. So I think the emphasis of my practice would be more, I shouldn't say, I don't actually like to say my practice, this is my practice and your practice, but this issue of being able to fall down in practice. We can have impeccable posture, but is it a posture that's ready to meet each person and each thing as it arises? my own life is kind of messy. So I always appreciate returning to the Zazen cushion and Zazen practice, the mind of Zazen. I don't know if that satisfied you or not. I couldn't see who was, maybe the person's on another screen. I couldn't see who was asking the question.
It was Peter.
Where?
Peter, do you want to raise your hand or something?
Peter Hewitt, I see you now. I see you. Okay, great. Okay. Other questions?
I think Jim has his hand raised.
Jim.
I'll let Barry go first. His hand was up first.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. I really enjoyed the talk. I have two questions about Toshoji.
Yes.
One is I looked real briefly at their webpage, and I see that the lineage comes from Harada Roshi, who's, I guess, famous for being a Soto priest who did koan, you know, the traditional koan curriculum. And I'm curious, is that maintained at Toshoji?
I'm not sure you got the right webpage.
Oh, okay.
Toshoji International. There are other temples called Toshoji. To find Toshoji, you need to look at Soto Zen Net.
I get it. Okay.
It's Toshoji International Senmon Soto in Okayama, Japan.
Okay. Thank you.
Okayama Prefecture.
Thank you for clarifying.
And teachers would sometimes teach koans, but it wasn't generally emphasized. It's actually kind of a fairly busy temple. It's traditionally a Baika temple, chanting of Baika. So people would come sometimes, they'd have a Baika conference and people would come and do Baika and that kind of thing. Many aspects, many people came for hojis, memorial services and those kinds of things, and we participated in those. Silence was emphasized. And work practice. We sat, but we also worked quite a bit. We did a lot of work practice.
Yeah. You partially answered my second question. I was going to ask how life is different at there compared to like a practice period at Tassajara. You know, in what ways is the experience different?
It's quite different. The Orioki, it's quite different and it's the same. At Toshoji, all the meals are Orioki. Very occasionally, you have a Western style meal. That's very, very occasional. While the meals are Orioki, for the most part, they're not in the soda. They sit at a long table on the floor and you pass your bowls back and forth. And breakfast is invariably rice gruel and a few pickles. That's it. Unless we have a special, if we're going to have a work day, then we might have a big breakfast with all kinds of things, toast and eggs and a great assortment of things. But generally, it's like that. And dinner is very light. That was one of the things for me that was difficult at Toshoji. When I came back, I was weighed 100 pounds, which is, you know, about 20 pounds less than I weigh now. But that was up from the 95 pounds I had dropped down to while I was there. There just wasn't enough food for me. That was kind of hard, the food aspect. Yeah. Jim?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'll just comment that after, I think my first practice period at Tassajara, I weighed 137 pounds and now I weigh 170.
Oh my goodness.
I lost, you know, you can lose a lot of weight, even with a richer diet. But anyway, that's not what I really wanted to talk about. I wanted to say that I'm sorry that, you know, we caused you and your mother trouble by
No, wait,
let me finish.
All right.
I was thinking of John Lewis, and he said, you know, what he liked to do was get into good trouble. I think that's what we sign up for, kind of as Dharma practitioners, is to, we know it's going to be a lot of trouble. But nevertheless, we do it anyway. I guess we just can't help it. But I agree too. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's the resistance. It's always the resistance to what needs to be done that makes so much trouble for us. It's the resistance itself. So I don't really have a question, I guess. I just wanted to say I'm sorry about the trouble.
I'm so grateful for your expression, and I just want to say it's a complete joy and delight to be here with you, and it's what I wanted to do. And there was, I don't give talks so easily. I'm not so facile when it comes to that. And this is just really the third talk since I came back from Japan. I gave one right away at Kanendo and Mountain View, and then I gave a class there recently, and then this is the third one. So I haven't done a lot of this recently since I've been here, but please trouble me. I'm so delighted to be with you all. And I also wanted to take this opportunity to say, this is in the time of, please don't worry about the Dana, because this is the time of I'm fine. I'm okay. Okay. So you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about that at all. And there's so much want in the world right now. So maybe we can all worry about that aspect. Not worry about it, but do what we can to take care of it. The want that is there in the world. Thank you for troubling me. I'm grateful. Dorley?
Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm so happy that you're with us. And I want to express my appreciation, especially for that opening up of the question at the end. And I want to go to the Avatamsaka Sutra, because it's almost as if living with the question is the practice in a way. Like if I can just live the moment with the question rather than needing the answer, I feel more humble inside and more open, I guess. And also, so it's almost like I'd like to have those questions sort of like a chant. So
I would say so, Dorley. And Siddhana, he asked Manjushri this question, and Manjushri says, go and see this enlightening being. And each enlightening being has incredible practices that they do. Mm. And each one tells him at the end, I've learned this meditation, and they show him amazing things. And they say, but how can I know the practice of enlightening beings? You have to go and see so-and-so. Uh-huh. So, of course, to have the question, and I think holding the question, not even as words, mm-hmm. not as words, but allowing, I find reading sutras, I allow them to perfume my life. Mm-hmm. And that perfuming, then it has some impact on my interactions with others, because when I might in the past have allowed my judgments to come to the fore, I can hold them back and consider, is that warranted? Mm. Is that legitimate in that moment? And I can respond perhaps in a more skillful way. Mm-hmm. Not always, but also when I don't respond in a more skillful way, I see it.
Yeah.
I see it. Mm. So I share your wish to allow that question to inform my life.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I think
Linda.
Kathy, it's so wonderful to see you again.
And to see you as well, Linda.
I just wanted to comment on your comment about the monastery in Japan being emphasizing silence, because I remember working with you in the kitchen, being so impressed with your silence. It's hard for me to be silent, and you were so at ease with it. It seemed to me anyway, with silence, you never seemed to have a need to fill up space unnecessarily with chatter or anything. Anyway, that's what I remember the most about working with you in the kitchen. And it's wonderful to see you now.
It's wonderful to see you, Linda. And I hope my silence is more embracing now than it was at that time. I think I was a little actually rigid with silence, you know, a little, if one can cling to silence. Yeah. And be really disturbed by noise.
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Yeah.
Dr. Roshi encouraged us to be silent, but he was often chastising us for not being so. It was actually quite a bit of talking at times.
Okay. Well. The talk this evening was wonderful too.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
All right.
Or felt some benefit from it.
I did.
Are there other questions people have?
Am I still live here? I think I am. Okay. I didn't mute. I wanted to mention that, I took Reb's intensive on the Lotus Sutra. I was able to participate in that recently. And one of the little revelations from that was, well, there are many touch points with Dogen's teaching in the Lotus Sutra. And one of them that was so surprising to me was in the first chapter of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha's death is described as just as firewood is completely burned up and becomes ash. So the Buddha was, you know, was extinct and at his death, and he wasn't going to return. And it was, when I read that, which is in the verse section of the first chapter, I was just bowled over to think that maybe Dogen had copped that image from the Lotus Sutra.
So. Yes, Dogen Zenji actually has quite a lot of imagery from the Lotus Sutra. Yeah. Quite a lot in the translations by who is it? Let me see. It's by Nichijima and Cross. I had to look at the spine of the book there in the moment. Nichijima and Cross, the translations in those, which I think those may be, I think those are actually available online. You can download the PDF file from the Numata Center if you're interested in looking up those. But there's a compilation of Dogen's, Dogen Zenji's allusions to the alluding to the Lotus Sutra. And I also found reading the Flower Ornament Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra, I have to maybe go back and read it again, but it's quite an arduous read. There's also things in there that also show up both in Dogen, Zenji's writings, and also in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. I was surprised by that. There were things in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind that I'm not sure I can think of something. Well, one thing is there's some place in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind where Suzuki Roshi talks about the past becoming present, about how time goes from present to future, but it also goes from present to past, something like that, and or from future to past. And that's actually in the Avatamsaka Sutra. I was surprised to see that. Also, there's a reference where he talks about our having Mahayana mind with Hinayana practice with Mahayana mind. So Peter's question about posture, was your question, right, Peter, about posture? Yeah, that's a Hinayana mind, that deportment of unmoving deportment and sitting in silent meditation and all of that. But that actually is in also in the Flower Ornament Sutra, the idea of this wide Mahayana mind with the deportment of a, the Shravaka, as they say, a learner, one of the vehicles for learners.
I think Meg has her hand up.
Yes, Meg?
Yeah, Meg? I just wanted to share that
Meg.
How touched I was by the fact that your care of your mother and your resistance to that interfering with this, in fact, informed this and gave a life to it of your personal reflection and ability to share what was going on for you that gave body to this talk tonight. And I wanted to thank you for that, you sharing that deep part of that, which to me gave the rest of it a great deal. I understand the reticence to speak up, but it's profound, and I wanted to thank you.
Thank you for your encouraging words. Appreciate it.
Your whole talk was encouraging.
I don't see any more hands raised. Maybe we can end with the echo, the after lecture chant.
I just want to first say how grateful I am to be with each and every one of you. Each person here, I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.